It took discipline to overcome old habits and subconscious sabotage. It was really tempting to come home from work and say, "Oh, I'm tired," and go to bed without doing it. I really had to view it as a practice, just like yoga. Practice is something you do even when you don't want to. Rediscovering her sensual self went far beyond the bedroom. Giselle started taking salsa lessons and rediscovering the incredible pleasure of feeling comfortable as a sexual being, comfortable in her own skin. She finally felt free to express herself, not in a haphazard manner, but free from unwarranted guilt or shame. The mind can rationalize terrible voids, and there is no need for it. Life is short, and sex should be a wonderful part of it. It's a fundamental part of our natural hardwiring. Isn't it time you let your hair down and had some real fun with it? All it takes is 15 minutes. Sex Machine 1. Adventures in Tripling Testosterone. Noonish, one beautiful Saturday, San Francisco, 21 floors above the Embarcadero piers. That's kind of creepy. They're already 75% healed. Maria had come out of the shower and was staring at my shoulders. Are you kidding? It's fucking awesome. I'm becoming Wolverine. I was referring to, of course, the superhero with mutant healing powers. He also has adamantium claws, but that's where Maria was a much better comparison. The night before, she'd inflicted bedroom wounds on my back and arms that couldn't really be called scratches. The masterpiece? 4 4-to-7-inch gashes in my right shoulder streaming blood, making me look like Bruce Lee from Enter the Dragon. Bruce in dire need of Neosporin. Now, less than 10 hours later, 3 of the gashes had disappeared completely, and the last and deepest was barely visible. Strange. The strangeness had actually started earlier, well before the bedroom, at the Americano restaurant. Friday at 8 p.m. brought the crowds, and the alpha investment bankers were fighting the alpha lawyers for female attention everywhere inside and around Hotel Vital. The press shirts and dresses spilled from the outdoor patio into the restaurant, where we had reservations. It took a chaperone, using football-like blocking, to get us to our booth table in a secluded back corner. The catch-up chat with Marie looked like this. Her: how are you? Me: unbelievable, but I need to give you fair warning. My biochemistry is very different from the last time you saw me. I feel, well, superhuman. Her: eyebrows raised. Oh, really? Details, please. Yes, really. The last time I'd seen her, I had just taken my total testosterone from 244.8 to 653.3 ng per dl, nanograms per deciliter, while cutting my estradiol, estrogen, in half. The subsequent roughhousing had been a physical encounter of the first class. This time around, I just returned from Nicaragua, where I ate grass-fed beef 3 times per day for 21 days, and I had protein-loaded for the last 3 days, eating 2 to 3 pounds of fatty organic grass-fed beef per day, including at least 400 grams just before bed. Don't worry, I won't suggest that you do this. The result? 15 minutes after we sat down, Marie was in a sexually aggressive stupor. The bread hadn't even arrived, and she was climbing on top of me. This is not a boast. It's a statement of pure confusion. She is a CEO, and this is not typical public CEO behavior. I thought she was on drugs. Heavy nose breathing and the whole lot, interrupted occasionally with, "What's going on? I don't understand what's going on." The whole spectacle was unreal. She was literally intoxicated on pheromones. I excused myself to the bathroom at one point, and what came next was even less believable. Totally absurd. But it did happen, and Marie witnessed it when we left. Both on my way to the bathroom and coming back to the table, it was as if I had a 10-foot radius field of hormonal impact. I received at least 3 times the normal eye contact from women. The animal kingdom was alive and well in San Francisco. Dinner ended immediately thereafter, and it was a short trip to her apartment on the 21st floor and our version of Enter the Dragon, complete with furniture smashing and most of the same sound effects. The next morning, after more of the same, I asked her, "Do you have a gong on the other side of your headboard?" It turned out to be metal artwork hanging on a neighbor's wall. After her second quick shower and taking another look at my shoulder, Marie glanced up at me and had just one thing to say. "Whatever you're doing, keep doing it." Things hadn't always been this way. In fact, for several years, things were quite the opposite. Somewhere between late 2007 and 2009, at 30 to 32 years old, I found myself in an odd place. Well able to perform in the bedroom as I had in college, but having less and less desire to do so. Even with the most attractive of girls, after a week or two of rabid love, sex frequency would drop to once a day. Then it would drop to a few times a week, or in some cases, once a week. I enjoyed sex as much as ever, once in the act, but fatigue or disinterest often led me to opt out. "I'd get to it in the morning" became a constant self-promise, often unfulfilled. It made no sense. I was young, athletic, and felt perfectly healthy. But looking under the hood, I also tested in the lower range of normal for total testosterone and blood testing. What was the problem? Testosterone is a molecule of many dependencies. The hypothalamus releases gonadotropin-releasing hormone, GnRH, which tells the pituitary, anterior pituitary, gland to release luteinizing hormone, LH, and follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH. LH then stimulates the Leydig cells in the testicles to produce, ta-da, testosterone. It is a major but rampant mistake to treat low testosterone with external testosterone in the form of a gel or injection without troubleshooting the upstream parts of the axis first. It's also a mistake to think of low libido as strictly a low testosterone problem. In 2004, I experimented with a hormone and drug called human chorionic gonadotropin, commonly known as HCG, which effectively acts as a form of luteinizing hormone. Injected once per week, it immediately had the effect of more than tripling seminal volume and requiring ejaculation 3 to 4 times per day just to think straight. If you want to kill productivity, look no further than HCG. This inconvenience was compensated for by sex with my girlfriend, which jumped from a few times a week to a few times a day. Happy days. My solution? 2 protocols. I didn't consume much red meat for my first increase from 244.8 to 653.3 ng per dl, and I believe this type of jump can be achieved without eating red meat at all. The meat marathon was actually for tracking changes in food allergies. I now use 2 protocols that I believe are effective for increasing both testosterone and LH based on repeated blood test results. Neither requires needles or prescription meds. The first is for long-term maintenance and general well-being. The second is for short-term nitro boosts of sex drive and testosterone. Sheer fun, in other words. If you're curious, you can find the detailed rationales behind each in Sex Machine 2. But let's start with the nutshell version. Protocol number 1. Long-term and sustained. Fermented cod liver oil plus vitamin-rich butterfat. 2 capsules upon waking and before bed. Vitamin D3, 3,000 to 5,000 IU upon waking and before bed, 6,000 to 10,000 IU per day, until reaching blood levels of 55 ng per ml. Short ice baths and or cold showers, 10 minutes each, upon waking and right before bed. Brazil nuts, 3 nuts upon waking, 3 nuts before bed. Protocol number 2, short-term and fun nitro boost. 20 to 24 hours prior to sex, eat at least 800 milligrams of cholesterol. Example, 4 or more large whole eggs or egg yolks. Within 3 hours of bedtime, the night before you want to be a sex maniac. The Wolverine intro to this chapter was partially thanks to 2 3/4 pound ribeye steaks the night before, but it's easier to stomach hard-boiled eggs. Why before bed? Testosterone is derived from cholesterol, which is primarily produced at night during sleep, between midnight and 4 to 6 a.m. 4 hours prior to sex, Brazil nuts, 20 raw almonds, 2 capsules of the fermented cod butter combination. Eager to give it a shot? This chapter is enough to get started, but the real magic happens when we finesse the details. Perfecting sleep. Engineering the perfect night's sleep. God, what a beautiful beach. Calm. Translucent turquoise water. I should really go back to Thailand. I wonder what time it is in Thailand. But why is there a mangy German shepherd on my beach? Orange collar? That makes no sense. Kind of looks like John's dog. Oh, actually, I owe John a call. Fuck, did I put his birthday party in the calendar? Birthdays and clowns. Clowns? Why the hell am I thinking about clowns? And so my internal monologue continues until 3, 4, or even 6 a.m., rotating through images, ideas, commitments, anxieties, and fantasies. This mental slideshow is combined with perverse sleep yoga, sometimes the twisted into a pretzel posture, sometimes lying on my back like Dracula in mock paralysis, and always ending in a last-ditch fetal position with a pillow or arm between the knees. Fetal position never works, but I continue to try it, like a full-bladdered dog scratching at a door that never opens. I have insomnia. Horrific onset insomnia. My brother and father are the same. It's not because we're stressed out, necessarily. It's not because we're not tired. It's because we just can't freaking fall asleep. So in the interest of finally getting a good night's rest and helping others with insomnia, I tried everything from folk remedies to smart drugs, from light therapy to fat leaching. Now I can say that I had chronic insomnia. The hidden third of life. Is good sleep a simple matter of length? The longer the better? If you've ever needed a nap after sleeping too much, you know it isn't that simple. Let's look at the problem through an easier question. What is bad sleep? Taking too long to get to sleep, onset insomnia, my major problem. Waking too often throughout the night, middle insomnia. Waking too early and being unable to get back to sleep, terminal insomnia. The challenge for a self-tracker is measuring things when drooling into a pillow. I could record the times when I got into bed and when I woke up, but I couldn't pinpoint when I fell asleep, much less what happened while asleep. Taking courses like Biology of Sleep at Stanford University didn't fix my insomnia, but the academic searching did help me formulate more specific questions, including, for memory consolidation, how much REM sleep am I experiencing? For tissue repair, how much delta wave sleep am I experiencing? For both of these, am I experiencing sleep apnea? The problem with testing these in a proper sleep lab, the test is called a polysomnogram, is that you generally have at least 22 wires attached to you to measure brain activity, EEG, eye movements, EOG, skeletal muscle activation, EMG, heart rhythm, ECG, respiration, and sometimes peripheral pulse oximetry. Guess what? No one can sleep in a weird lab with 22 wires attached to them on the first night, so the data are terrible. But let's assume you try. The second night, you come in after an all-nighter and crash within minutes like a post-sugar high 2-year-old. Double bad data. To really test and tweak things under realistic sleeping conditions, I would need a pocket-sized sleep lab. That wouldn't happen until 2009. July 2009. You should try what Brad Feld used. He has some gadget to measure your sleep, offered my friend, Matt Mullenweg. This caught my attention. I had been bitching about my insomnia after another horrible night's sleep, and I'd also been meaning to reach out to Brad. Based out of beautiful Boulder, Colorado, Brad is a venture capitalist and angel investor famous for, one, his incredible track record, and two, dropping F-bombs on business panels. Exhibit A, he was one of the few initial backers of Harmonix Music Systems, which he helped raise $500,000 in financing. They bled money for almost 11 years, a fool's errand. Then, in 2005, it had a small, read sarcasm, video game success called Guitar Hero. It sold in 2006 to Viacom MTV for $175 million. Brad's contrarian decisions often follow an elegant logic that others pick up on only well after the fact. If he had found a tool for sleep analysis, I wanted to know all about it. Brad's obsession ended up being the Zio. It would be my first legitimate next-generation sleep gadget. Then, I added to the list. In the subsequent 4 months of testing, I also used heart rate monitors, thermometers, continuous glucose monitors, 2 movement detection devices, Fitbit and WakeMate, and video recording of sleep movement, often all simultaneously. I looked like a comatose RoboCop. Both WakeMate and Fitbit, worn on your wrist during sleep, use motion sensing technology, accelerometry, similar to what's found in a Nintendo Wii controller. The data are interpreted using actigraphy algorithms, which are used to determine whether someone is awake or in one of the various stages of sleep. WakeMate features an alarm clock that can be set to wake you during specific arousal points in REM sleep, ostensibly to minimize grogginess, up to 30 minutes before a chosen wake time. The Zio, in contrast, uses a headband that measures electrical patterns generated in the brain. It also has an alarm clock intended to wake you during periods of most elevated brain activity, to minimize grogginess. The first attempts to track and fix things were not encouraging. For both accelerometer devices, time to fall asleep, the critical problem of onset insomnia, did not appear accurate. Despite claims to the contrary, it didn't appear that the accelerometers could distinguish between simple lack of movement and sleeping. I tested this by watching television for 30 minutes, remaining as perfectly still as possible before attempting to sleep. My sleep started approximately when I started watching TV. The first good news came a week later. The intelligent alarms, Zio and WakeMate, seemed to reduce grogginess. I was less bastardly in the morning and could think without 2 cups of coffee. Placebo or true cause and effect, the smart alarms seemed to help. This was an improvement, but I needed better sleep, not just better wake times. This is where the Zio came in. I began with a trial period of answering a subjective question each morning and assigning a number. Do I feel like shit? 1 to 3. Or do I feel awesome? 8 to 10. Nebulous answers between 4 and 7 that would skew interpretation were logged but ignored. In both extreme ranges, I then looked for patterns. Thanks to the continuous glucose monitoring, I also had food logs to use. Here are some of the initial findings. Good sleep, 8 to 10, was most dependent on the ratio of REM to total sleep, not total REM duration. The higher the percentage of REM sleep, the more restful the sleep. The higher the REM percentage, the better the recall of skills or data acquired in the previous 24 hours. Higher percentage REM sleep also correlated to lower average pulse and temperature upon waking. I could increase REM percentage by extending total sleep time past 9 hours, or by waking for 5 minutes approximately 4.5 hours after sleep onset. One waking of 5 to 10 minutes approximately 4.5 hours after sleep onset dramatically increased REM percentage. It seems that one waking is not necessarily a bad thing, at least when intentional. Taking 200 milligrams of Huperzine A 30 minutes before bed can increase total REM by 20 to 30%. Huperzine A, an extract of Huperzine serrata, slows the breakdown of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. It is a popular, nootropic, smart drug, and I have used it in the past to accelerate learning and increase the incidence of lucid dreaming. I now only use Huperzine A for the first few weeks of language acquisition and no more than 3 days per week to avoid side effects. Ironically, one documented side effect of overuse is insomnia. The brain is a sensitive instrument, and while generally well tolerated, this drug is contraindicated with some classes of medications. Speak with your doctor before using. The higher the percentage of deep wave sleep, the better your subsequent physical performance. More than 2 glasses of wine within 4 hours of sleep decreases deep wave sleep 20 to 50%. Even 4 glasses 6 hours beforehand did not appear to have this effect, so the timing is crucial. Conversely, taking 15-plus drops of California poppy extract appeared to increase deep wave sleep up to 20%. Eating 2 tablespoons of organic almond butter on celery sticks before bed eliminated at least 50% of the feel-like-shit, 1 to 3, mornings. Ever wonder how you can sleep 8 to 10 hours and feel tired? The likely culprit? Low blood sugar. Make a pre-bed snack part of your nutritional program. 1 to 2 tablespoons of flaxseed oil, 120 to 240 calories, can be used in combination with the celery and almond butter to further increase cell repair during sleep and thus decrease fatigue. Flaxseed oil tastes like a mixture of cat urine and asparagus, so if you opt to include it, I recommend pinching your nose while consuming it, per Dr. Seth Roberts. Engineering more restful sleep out of the way, I moved on to the biggest problem: getting to sleep in the first place. No matter how theoretically restful my sleep should be, based on Zio results, more than 30 minutes of onset insomnia negated it all. What follows are the changes and tools that had the largest and most predictable effects on time to sleep. Some of them are more convenient than others. I excluded drugs from testing, and if a given improvement couldn't be replicated at least 3 times on consecutive nights, it was omitted. Test 67 to 70 degrees as your bedroom temperature. This was the variable I experimented with most, and it was also the variable that had the most consistent effects. Specifically, using a single bed sheet at room temperature between 67 degrees Fahrenheit and 70 degrees Fahrenheit produced the fastest time to sleep. Warmer temperatures never worked, but as low as 65 degrees Fahrenheit would work equally well if I wore socks to keep my feet warm. If you can't control the ambient temperature, testing socks of different thicknesses is the easiest variable to change for tweaking heat loss. Ideal temperature is highly individual, and each person will have a narrow range, so experiment to find your own. Eat a large fat and protein-dominated meal within 3 hours of bedtime. I discovered this unintentionally while tracking testosterone changes. Consumed within 3 hours of getting under the sheets, meals of at least 800 milligrams of cholesterol, 4 or more large whole eggs, and 40 grams of protein produced dramatically faster time-to-sleep scores than meals of lower volume or lower protein and fat. Eating 2 ribeye steaks, each about 3/4 of a pound, had the strongest tranquilizer-like effect. Use light cues. The Philips Go Light. I bought this high-end blue light emitter for a friend who suffers from seasonal affective disorder, SAD, a.k.a. mild to severe depression during winter months. He already owned the same device, so I began to use it as a replacement for coffee first thing in the morning. I set it to the side of my laptop, pointing at me for 15 minutes at about a 30-degree off-center angle. If noon is my laptop, pointing at me from 10 a.m. or 2 p.m. That evening, my time to sleep was less than 10 minutes for the first time in weeks. I was able to replicate the effect 4 nights out of 5. Though most often used for jet lag or winter depression, I found the Go Light to be singularly most useful as a corrective sleep tool, even if I wake up late and need to go to bed at a normal hour. Battery life is long, and, at the size of a small square book, the Go Light is portable enough to fit in a carry-on travel bag. Tax the nervous system with isolateral movements. Exercise is commonly recommended to improve sleep. The problem for me was that results were unpredictable. I might exercise for 20 minutes and fall asleep in 10 minutes. Or I might exercise for an hour and fall asleep in 2 hours. There was no repeatable cause and effect, and it seemed like a coin toss. This changed when I began to incorporate isolateral, one arm or one leg, resistance training. I logged faster to sleep times after 8 out of 10 training sessions. The more complex the stabilization required, the shorter the to sleep time. Take a cold bath 1 hour prior to bed. The Japanese have longer average lifespans than most other ethnicities, including Americans, whom they beat by more than 4 years. One explanation researchers have proposed is that the regular ofuro, or hot bath at bedtime, increases melatonin release and its related mechanisms for life extension. Paradoxically, according to one of the Stanford professors who taught the sleep biology class I took circa 2002, cold is a more effective signaler, aka Zeitgeber, or time giver, for sleep onset. Perhaps the ofuro effect was related to the subsequent rapid cooling? Not eager to kill my swimmies with hot baths, I opted for direct cold. I tested the effect of combining shorter than usual 10-minute ice baths with low-dose melatonin, 1.5 to 3 milligrams, 1 hour prior to sleep. The ice bath is simple. Put 2 to 3 bags of ice from a convenience store, $3 to $6, into a half-full bathtub until the ice is about 80% melted. Beginners should start by immersing the lower body only and progress to spending the second 5 minutes with the upper torso submerged as well, keeping the hands out of the water. It was like getting hit with an elephant tranquilizer. Best of all, this was true even when the melatonin was emitted. Use an ultrasonic humidifier. The Aero Swiss Travel Ultrasonic Cool Mist Humidifier is incredible. It is small enough to fit in a jacket pocket, 1.3 pounds, because its water source comes from any convenience store, a plastic water bottle turned upside down. The ultrasonic technology uses high-frequency vibrations to generate a micro-fine cool mist, which is blown into the room where it evaporates into the air. This device is my go-to combination with a Go Light, especially after seeing how well it eliminates sinus problems while traveling. It also dramatically reduces facial wrinkles, which was an unexpected but pleasant side effect. The Aero Swiss humidifier comes with a transcontinental travel AC adapter and exchangeable plugs that can be used in both the United States and Europe. My only complaint? It emits a stylish but distracting blue glow, so you'll need an eye mask if you're light sensitive like I am. Use a Nightwave pulse light. The Nightwave was introduced to me by a good friend named Michael, who also has severe onset insomnia. During my testing, he started ranting and raving about this tiny device, a slow pulsing light the size of a cigarette pack, that helped him get to sleep in less than 7 minutes. Dr. James B. Moss, Vice Presidential Fellow and Professor of Psychology at Cornell University, is one of several researchers who have endorsed it. From the Nightwave website. Nightwave projects a soft blue light into your darkened bedroom. The luminance of the light slowly rises and falls. Lie with eyes open and synchronize your breathing with the blue wave as its movement becomes slower and slower. After a short time, the cycle Michael used was 7 minutes long, Nightwave shuts off and you roll over and fall asleep. Unlike sound machines, the soft light does not disturb others. It does work, but I found it less consistent than Michael did. His hit rate was near 100%. I now travel with the Nightwave, but use it as a supplement to the Go Light when needed. Given the cost differential, it will make sense for most people to experiment with the Nightwave, $40, before purchasing the Go Light, $350. Resort to the half-military crawl position. This suggestion came from polling more than 70,000 Twitter followers for successful treatments for onset insomnia. Lie on your chest with your head on a pillow and turn to the right. Both arms should be straight by your sides, palms up. Now bring your right arm up until the top of your right elbow is bent at 90 degrees and your hand is close to your head. Alternative hand placement, the right hand is under your pillow and under your head. Next, bring your right knee out to that side until it is bent at approximately 90 degrees. This is a last resort that works for one simple reason. You can't move. It's like a self-imposed papoose, which the Inuits and other cultures have used to calm infants by immobilizing them. To toss and turn from the half-military crawl position, you have to first lift your entire body off the bed. Less fidgeting means faster sleep. On longer and better life. This will be the shortest chapter on life extension ever written. Let it begin, as all good short chapters do, with a story of two monkeys. Canto and Owen. Housed at the University of Wisconsin, these two rhesus monkeys are as close to identical as possible, with one exception. Canto is on a diet. Specifically, his calories are restricted to 30% less than normal. He is part of a semi-fasting group of monkeys that has been on the 200 equivalent of Weight Watchers for two decades. Owen, in the feasting control group, is a stark contrast. He eats whatever the hell he wants. To date, in this 20-plus year experiment, 37% of the Eat, Drink, and Be Merry group have died due to causes related to old age. The calorie counting group has a much lower death rate, almost two-thirds lower. Cancel our reservations at the Cheesecake Factory. In fact, it's time to cancel dinner forever. Or, wait a second, is that really all there is to the story? Which brings me to low-cal Canto and high-cal Owen. Canto looks drawn, weary, ashen and miserable in his thinness. Mouth slightly agape, features pinched, eyes blank, his expression screaming, "Please! No, not another plateful of seeds!" Well-fed Owen, by contrast, is a happy camper with a wry smile. Every inch the laid-back simian, plump, eyes twinkling, full mouth relaxed, skin glowing, exuding wisdom as if he's just read Kierkegaard and concluded that life must be lived forward but can only be understood backward. It's the difference between the guy who got the marbleized ribeye and the guy who got the oh-so-lean filet. Or between the guy who got a Chateau Grand Ponte Saint-Emilion with his brie and the guy who got water. As Edgar notes in King Lear, ripeness is all. You don't get to ripeness by eating apple peel for breakfast. When life extension supplants life quality as a goal, you get the desolation of Canto the monkey. Living to 120 holds zero appeal for me. Canto looks like he's itching to be put out of his misery. We don't understand what the mind secretes. The process of aging remains full of enigma. But I'd bet on jovial Owen outliving wretched Canto. Laughter extends life. There's little of it in the low-cal world, and little doubt Pudgy Owen will have the last laugh. If your goal is to live as long as possible, there is a long list, an endless list, of things to avoid. The good news is that life extension need not be complicated. For the gents, it may be as simple as blocking a few websites and curbing a little maleness. The pro-ejaculation lobby slipped up in 1992, when the New York Times broke the story, in Worm, at least, making sperm is found to shorten a male's life. See, Dr. Wayne Van Voorhees of the University of Arizona had allowed nematodes, also called roundworms, to kill themselves by copulating. In his research, nematodes prevented from mating lived an average of 11.1 days. Nematodes allowed to drop their drawers lived a scant 8.1 days. Never got to see the grandkids grow up. Never got to play golf at St. Andrews. It's a sad tale of weary scrotums, or whatever worms have as scrotums. The genes and biochemical processes nematodes use are the same as those that humans and other mammals use, elaborated Dr. Philip Anderson of the University of Wisconsin. The Times connected the logical dots in their conclusion. Ceaseless sperm production takes its toll on a male, perhaps requiring the use of complex enzymes or biochemical processes that have harmful metabolic effects. The difference in lifespan between men and women, women live an average of 6 years longer, just may be linked to sperm production. Finally, no more ejaculating. It's like finding out that flossing is bad for you. No more tiring sex or arching wrists. Hassle removed. And you might live 37% longer. In the quest for longer life, it pays dividends to err on the side of caution, to avoid any unnecessary risks or unknowns. To live, after all, you don't need much. Air, water, gruel with some protein, and shelter will cover all the bases. One could therefore suggest no venturing outside the home, no driving or traveling, and certainly no exposure to other humans who could be sick with cat flu or diaper rash. Of course, this level of risk avoidance leads naturally to what we all want, a long-ass shitty life. But let's assume you're one of the few billion people who wants a degree of fun and freedom in life. The real question then becomes not, how can I extend life at all costs? But rather, how can I increase the length of my life without severely decreasing my quality of life? The most basic approach would be to eat, drink, and be merry and believe that a few more laughs and tasty calories will beat most lab theories in the long run. I believe this to be true. The second complementary approach, which can be followed right along with the first, is to consider therapies that are minimally inconvenient and that, based on the scientific literature, should work in humans. This short list of therapies should then be ethically filtered. Ethics can be nebulous, but here's an example. If you're a woman and want to buy cancer insurance, you could opt to have a full-term pregnancy before age 20. Some scientists believe it could be the most effective natural means of protecting against breast cancer due to the hormone HCG. Should you therefore have children before age 20? I would suggest that life extension is not a good enough reason, particularly since another life is involved. It's therefore omitted from our list. Separating the wheat from the chaff, we might consider four candidates that make the cut. Resveratrol. Injections of the immunosuppressant drug rapamycin. Alzheimer's vaccines. Stem cell therapies. These might just get you to 200 or beyond, especially if used in combination. And I'm avoiding them. But why? I believe, as do some scientists, that focusing on global therapies, drugs or treatments with broad molecular effects, without long-term human data, is barking up the wrong tree, a tree fraught with unpredictable side effects. Take resveratrol, for example, which is currently available over-the-counter. It is effective in extending lifespan in nearly all species tested, but it can also block or activate estrogen receptors. Could this affect other metabolic or hormonal feedback loops, perhaps disrupting fertility if taken routinely? It's impossible to say, which is precisely why I'll use resveratrol short-term at higher doses for endurance while tracking blood markers, but I won't use it indefinitely for life extension. Telomerase activators, like TA65, another example, are purported to extend our chromosomal countdown clocks called telomeres. TA65 can cost up to $15,000 per year. Is it possible that by amplifying cell replication, you increase the likelihood of dangerous cancerous growth? Perhaps. It's simply beyond our technology to guarantee one outcome or another, so I'm avoiding it. But if not in global therapies, where is the promised land? Until we can go to Walmart and get a RoboCop makeover with regenerative medicine, there are a few alternatives in a second short list. These are the protocols I am currently using. All of them are low cost, low tech, and low risk. Most of them also provide athletic or body composition benefits, even if their life extension effects are later debunked. Cycles of 5 to 10 grams of creatine monohydrate cost $20 a month. Creatine monohydrate, popular among power athletes since its commercialization in 1993, has recently become a candidate for minimizing or preventing the development of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's diseases. There is almost 20 years of published research involving human use of creatine monohydrate, and since my family has Alzheimer's and Parkinson's on both paternal and maternal sides, it is low-cost insurance. I'm ingesting 5 to 10 grams of creatine monohydrate powder per day for 2 consecutive weeks every 2 months. If you choose to use this protocol, I suggest tracking and trending hepatic enzymes, BUN, and all the usual blood testing suspects to ensure no kidney problems. Complications are rare, but an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Nowhere is this truer than in life extension. Intermittent fasting, IF, and protein cycling. Cost? Free. What if poor, hungry Kanto only needed to fast on occasion to extend his life? Constant caloric deprivation isn't without risks, after all. The decline in sex hormone production alone can cause amenorrhea, cessation of menstruation, and bone thinning, among other problems. It turns out that you can mimic, even exceed, the supposed life-extending effects of caloric restriction with intermittent fasting, IF. This can be true even if you consume twice as many calories as normal during your on days, resulting in no total decrease in weekly calories. There are several popular versions of IF and semi-IF protocols among experimental subcultures. Fast 5. Fast for 19 hours beginning at bedtime, followed by 5 hours of eating as much as necessary to satisfy hunger. This is popular for moderate weight loss, which typically appears starting in the third week and averages 1 pound of loss per week thereafter. Some research suggests IF confers the same life extension benefits as caloric restriction only when calories are consumed during daylight hours. This would, if accurate, make the Fast 5 better for fat loss than longevity. ADCR. Alternate day caloric restriction, ADCR, which requires that calories be cut 50 to 80% every other day, has been shown to improve insulin sensitivity, autoimmune disease, and even asthma after just 2 weeks. Protein cycling. Dr. Ron Migneri, author of The Protein Cycling Diet, suggests that even a single day per week of restricting protein to no more than 5% of total maintenance calories can produce effects similar to extended caloric restriction. If the mechanism of IF or CR is triggering a genetic self-preservation response, protein cycling makes sense. There are no essential dietary carbohydrates. Simply reducing calories, or carbs, wouldn't necessarily qualify as a biological emergency. On the other hand, even brief absences of essential amino acids like lysine might be enough to flip the switch. The switch, in our context, is triggering a process of cellular housekeeping, the purpose of which, in Dr. Migneri's words, to clear the cell of degraded and aggregated proteins that are not being handled by other recycling mechanisms of the cell. In principle, if you clear the junk out faster than it builds up, you postpone or reverse aging. I'm currently experimenting with both 18-hour and one-day protein cycling, which I believe, and it's pure conjecture, can also increase subsequent protein synthesis during overfeeding. For muscular growth phases, I have used the 18-hour protein cycling once per week precisely for this reason, usually ending between noon and 2 p.m. on my Saturday cheat day. Here's a sample menu for one day of less than 5% protein, adapted from Dr. Migneri. It is distinctively non-slow carb. Once you've cried a tear of dietary misery, I'll tell you what to do. Miscellaneous breakfast. Breakfast can include wheat-based, lysine-deficient products, such as toast, muffins, or bagels, provided that wheat is the only substantial source of protein and its calories are heavily diluted with calories from non-protein sources, butter, sugar, juice, fruit, etc. Toast with mushrooms, onions, and gravy. You can thicken the fat or drippings from meat with starch to make a gravy and drizzle it over the toast, mushrooms, and onions. Spinach with vinegar. Microwaved frozen spinach, less than 2 cups, can be flavored with any kind of vinegar for a near protein-free dish with the warmth and chew of meat. Meat substitutes. A microwaved slice of eggplant can fill a sandwich and give something of the shape and texture of a lunch meat. Black olives can also provide something of the texture of meat without the protein. Bean substitutes. Beans and peas are fairly high in protein and cannot be eaten in the restriction phase of protein cycling. But you can substitute spheres of cassava starch called tapioca pearls. They are a staple of tropical cuisine and are available in a wide range of sizes and colors. You may be familiar with them if you have ever had bubble tea. What I do? First, I drizzle fat gravy over a bowl of tapioca pearls. Kidding. I fast following an early Friday dinner, 6 p.m., and then around 10 a.m. the next morning, 16 hours later, I eat 1 cup spinach with vinegar and spices, 1 slice of sourdough toast with lots of butter, and enjoy it all with a large glass of grapefruit juice. Delish. Sometime after noon, I'll then head off to eat my usual chocolate croissants and continue cheat day as a binge monster. The lost art of bleeding. Cost free. Thought bloodletting went out of fashion around the time of the Salem witch trials? Not entirely. I'm betting on a major resurgence. It all has to do with excess iron. More than estrogen, it's thought to partially explain why postmenopausal, but not premenopausal, women have a similar incidence of heart attack to men. I've donated blood since 2001 to be on the safe side. I'm not alone. The New England Centenarian Study, conducted by Boston University's School of Medicine, is the world's largest and most comprehensive ongoing study of centenarians, people who live past 100. Dr. Tom Pearls, director of the study and an associate professor of medicine, gives blood every 8 weeks to mimic the loss of iron due to menstruation, which he believes will increase his longevity. Iron is a critical factor in our cells' ability to produce those nasty molecules called free radicals that play an important role in aging. It may be as simple as having less iron in your body. There is ample evidence that iron reduction through phlebotomy, bloodletting, can not only improve insulin sensitivity, but also reduce cancer-specific and all-cause deaths. High iron stores have been correlated to an increased number of heart attacks in otherwise symptom-free males. And blood donation has conversely been correlated to a decrease in cardiovascular incidence. Doctors Michael and Mary Danides suggest aiming for blood ferritin levels of 50 mg per dL, which, if your levels aren't over 400, can usually be achieved with 1 to 4 whole blood donations spread 2 months apart. No leeches required. If you'd like to increase the removal of pesticides and other environmental toxins that are normally stored in fat, you can fine-tune in two ways. Schedule to donate a double portion of plasma and drink a cup of caffeinated coffee about 60 minutes before going to the center. Donated blood will always contain such toxins, so you're not being a bad citizen by temporarily increasing their excretion. Though some scientists argue that iron depletion is necessary for full cardiac benefits, I see no harm in acting on the positive implications of dozens of other studies. Consensus won't come anytime soon, and even if you don't extend your own life, you might save someone else's. The Danish writer Hans Christian Andersen, beloved for his fairy tales, including The Little Mermaid and The Emperor's New Clothes, perhaps put it best. Just living is not enough. One must have sunshine, freedom, and a little flower. Extending life at the expense of quality of life makes little sense. It's easier, and lazier, to focus on subtraction and avoidance. But a life of constant denial is not a life of freedom. The greatest rewards come from a good life, not just a long life. This probably includes a bit of red wine and a few cheesecakes. Perhaps even an ejaculation or two. Closing thoughts. Running an ultramarathon can't be good for you. I can't imagine how it's possibly good for your body, I said. I wasn't biting on endurance. Running wasn't my thing, and it never had been. Brian McKenzie laughed. Good for you physically? No, but you'll recover. And I assure you, if you run 50K or 100 miles, when you finish, you won't be the same person who started. I thought for a minute, and that's when I bit. I'd seen a strange ripple effect dozens of times in the world of strength, but for some reason I'd never connected the dots with endurance. Perhaps just as you haven't connected the dots with some subjects in this audiobook. After all, in a knowledge economy, what's the value of deadlifting more or losing 2% body fat? In a word, transfer. My father lost 70-plus pounds of fat in 10 months and tripled his strength in almost all lifts. During his annual checkup, his doctor declared that he might live forever. The physical changes were incredible, but the curious side effects of the program were the strongest incentives to continue. As my dad explained, "It's very odd. I used to feel like the invisible man, but now people more readily ask my opinion and take me more seriously. I went from not being noticed to being noticed." Quite apart from the aesthetic and performance benefit, there's a huge social benefit. I lost my invisibility. Also, after losing 50 or 60 pounds and doing what you once thought impossible, you start to see other impossibilities, doubling income in 12 months or whatever, as possibilities. This audiobook is intended to make you a better all-around human. It's also intended to make you a role model for those around you. Your body, your temple of performance and appearance, is almost always within your control. This is rare in life, perhaps unique. Focusing on some measurable element of your physical nature prevents you from becoming a Dow Joneser, someone whose self-worth is dependent on things largely outside of their control. Job not going well, company having issues, some idiot making life difficult. If you add 10 laps to your swimming, or if you cut 5 seconds off your best mile time, it can still be a great week. Controlling your body puts you in life's driver's seat. Becoming the best version of yourself, doing what other people consider impossible, doesn't take much time. Nor does it take much money. It just takes a willingness to test drive the uncommon. To incorporate changes so small that you'll forget you've made them after 3 weeks. Refuse to accept partial completeness. Take the next step. Uncap a pen and take an inventory of all the things in the physical realm that you've resigned yourself to being poor at. Now ask, if you couldn't fail, what would you want to be exceptional at? Circle these alternate realities. This list, circles staring back at you, gives you a blueprint for not just a new body, but an entirely new life. I'm excited to see what you become. This is Zach McLarty. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The 4-Hour Body, The Secrets and Science of Rapid Body Transformation by Tim Ferriss. This program was directed by Danny Campbell. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Abridgment by John McElroy. Text copyright 2010 by Tim Ferriss. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.